Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is in re Dorothy Davis, bankruptcy debtor. For the bankruptcy trustee, Mr. Lovold, and for debtor Dorothy Davis, 15 minutes for Mr. James Craig, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and 5 minutes for Mr. David Wiest, who's an assistant attorney general. I assume representing the Department of Revenue. All right, okay. The sheet doesn't specifically say, and we're not a bankruptcy court. Are you considered the appellant?
I don't know, Justice. I honestly don't know. They told me to sit on the appellant side.
Well, it's a matter of a 10-minute rebuttal, and I'm trying to figure out who gets it. He is the appellant? All right. Then we'll go 20 minutes, Mr. Lovell. 20 minutes for you, gentlemen. 10-minute rebuttal. Okay? All right, Mr. Lovell, you may proceed.
To please the court, counsel, my name is John Lovold. I'm an attorney with the Olinger Law Firm here in Pierce, South Dakota. I also serve in the capacity as a Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustee in both the Central and the Southern Divisions of South Dakota. This particular case arose in the context of a bankruptcy filing in the Southern Division in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, by a debtor by the name of Dorothy Davis. In a Chapter 7 liquidation, by way of background, creditors can only expect to receive payment in the event that a debtor's assets exceed the exemptions that a debtor is allowed to take by law. South Dakota's an opt-out state. Our legislature has said that it has rejected the federal bankruptcy exemptions, and therefore the only exemptions that are available to a debtor that files a Chapter 7 bankruptcy are the exemptions granted by our state legislature. Mrs. Davis in this particular case was over the age of 70 on the date she filed her bankruptcy. She owned a home in Sioux Falls, South Dakota that she indicated on her schedules had a value of $95,000. In her testimony before me at the 341 meeting, she indicated she based that value on county assessed value, which would give you some indication that the home itself may actually be worth up to $110,000, since most counties work off approximately 85% of full and true in terms of valuing properties. She also testified and indicated in her schedules the only lien or potential lien against that property was approximately $1,669 in accrued or accruing but unpaid real estate taxes that she would owe on the property. There were no mortgages. At the time she filed her bankruptcy, she listed and scheduled approximately $46,000 worth of unsecured debt that she was asking be discharged and that she be relieved of as a result of the Chapter 7 bankruptcy process. Those debts were discharged by order of the bankruptcy court entered in March of 2003. Debtor on her schedules is claiming the entire equity in her home exempt under SDCL section 43453 subdivision 2. An objection was filed to her exemption claim in the bankruptcy court, and at the bankruptcy court level, two challenges to SDCL section 43453 2 were raised. Judge Hoyt, in his memorandum decision, indicated he felt it was appropriate to refer those matters to the district court for purposes of certification to this court to have the issues decided, since they were matters uniquely arising under South Dakota law and under the South Dakota Constitution. And that's how this case got here in terms of having started in bankruptcy court. The first challenge to SDCL 434532 is under Article 21, Section 4 of the South Dakota Constitution. And I'd like to focus on the particular language of the Constitution where it indicates that the right of the debtor to enjoy the comforts and necessities of life shall be recognized by wholesome laws exempting from forced sale a homestead, the value of which shall be limited and defined by law. It's my contention in this particular case that 4345.3.2 violates that section of the Constitution. The statute generally gives any citizen of the state of South Dakota the right to claim free from execution or levy homestead value up to $30,000. The last sentence of this section has removed that cap as far as any person over the age of 70 or the unremarried spouse of an individual over the age of 70, which probably implies that the spouse, if the principal claimant is deceased, might not even have to be 70 years old.
I know we're not really in rational reason territory like you would be for other constitutional provisions, but do we have any indication why this was done?
I think there's probably a general feeling, Justice, that older persons should enjoy broader homestead rights than the rest of the citizens of this state. But, beyond that, I can't give you any legislative history in terms of, why we went there or why we went there with no cap. This court in Skinner v. Holt, in dealing with an insurance exemption, has previously held that an exemption granted by the legislature with no value limitation did violate this section of the Constitution. I'm not aware of any case where the homestead portion of the constitutional provision has been squarely before the court, but if you look at the limitation contained in section or in Article 21 as it applies to personal property, and then compare the same limiting language that is used in the Constitution as to the homestead, it's really difficult to draw any sort of a distinction that the legislature has any more room to grant an unlimited homestead value right as to homestead property as opposed to personal property. It's been suggested in the briefs that the acreage limitations that have been built into our homestead statutes here in South Dakota would in some fashion address or satisfy the value limitation requirements of the constitutional provision. We have other statutes that provide that if you're in the country, the homestead can't exceed 160 acres. And I believe the same statute in a city would limit the area to not more than 1 acre. It's my opinion that the area limitations don't really deal with the value limitation built into the constitutional provision. And a good example is to simply survey property values across the state. If you're down in rural Minnehaha County adjacent to the city of Sioux Falls, you could well have a 100-acre tract with a house on it that would have resale value in excess of $1 million. If you get out into western South Dakota in the Harding County area, you might have 160 acres where you'd be hard-pressed to come up with a valuation of $16,000 total. Same thing applies to homes. You've got homes here in the city of Peary, you've got homes in the city of Sioux Falls that are pushing valuations of $500,000 or more. You've got some very nice homes in some of our smaller towns in the state of South Dakota that you could probably pick up for $10,000 or $15,000. So if you simply focus on areas, it's my feeling that the analysis really is irrelevant to the issue of valuation.
That kind of a description does provide some limit, though, does it not?
It provides a limit.
So this issue, in a way, almost comes down to a matter of degree, because, you know, if it's 160 acres or it's 1 acre, that does put some limitation on it.
It's an area limitation, but where the Constitution requires the legislature to limit and define value, I think it's an awfully weak approach in terms of the legislature having gotten there.
Acreage isn't synonymous with value, is what you're saying.
That's my contention, Justice. At the bankruptcy court level, I did make an argument to the bankruptcy judge that you could interpret the statute in a manner that would place some limitation on the claim. My argument to the court was that 43-45-3 provides the unlimited exemption, quote unquote, so long as the property retains its homestead character. My argument to the court was, we can be patient, allow the debtor to occupy the property as long as they would need it or desire to use it, but at the time that the homestead use ceased, you could then go ahead and take, well, for sure, the value in excess of the $30,000 and go ahead and pay the creditor's claims. The debtor opposed my argument. The contention is that at the time you file your bankruptcy, as of date of filing, you take a snapshot. And the issue as you move from property category to property category is, does this property on that date qualify for an exemption? The argument was, if it does, the inquiry ends and you don't look back. Judge Hoyt, in looking at that issue, indicated in his decision that he was bound by the Eighth Circuit precedent to basically use the snapshot approach. In other words, you look at the property as of date of filing. If it qualifies as a homestead, the inquiry ends and the debtor receives their discharge. So that particular attempt on my part to put the limitation on the homestead right was not successful.
Have you seen instances where this particular device is being used as an estate planning tool to enable people to pass their property on without having to pay their debt?
My answer is yes. And I think I've had it come up 4 times this year, and I don't know at what point I inappropriately get outside of this record. I'm happy to field questions, but
I think you've answered my question.
I have seen it. The other area where I think that probably comes up under the second prong of my argument. But the bottom line is, as to the first challenge, I think Article 21, Section 4. Directed that the legislature define and limit value, and I don't think this particular statute in this case has done that. The second challenge is under our Equal Protection Clause, Article 6, Section 18, and I'll grant that on that particular constitutional provision, I think the legislature enjoys more latitude in terms of distinguishing or differentiating between two classes. A good example on personal property, the legislature currently provides a head of household can exempt up to $6,000 worth of property. Any other individual can exempt $4,000. When I first started to do this work, those limitations were 2 and 4. And quite frankly, in the 20-some years I've been doing trustee work, it's never crossed my mind that there's any sort of unconstitutional discrimination going on as to those laws, because I mean, you look at the statutes and your first blush assessment is that makes sense. My contention on Article 6, Section 18, though, is that, again, I think you have to look at the fact that the legislature didn't put any cap on value. If the legislature had said elderly persons over the age of 70 are entitled to a value of $45,000 or $60,000 as opposed to the rest of us, I think you'd have some benchmarks to actually go through the analysis. Number one, is the classification arbitrary? And secondly, does it serve some legitimate legislative purpose? But where you have one class, where you're basically saying through the legislature, citizens are entitled to protect their homestead value up to $30,000. You have another class of citizens where the legislature has basically abdicated any type of value limitation and has allowed you to look at it and say the sky's the limit. You can have a $500,000 homestead, a $300,000 homestead. I think we're getting into the area where you have an argument that, number one, the two classes, or the unlimited class, is arbitrary, and secondly, if you're looking at a $500,000 home, where you're at the same time telling the creditors of that person that they are not going to receive any payment in the bankruptcy, that you may not be serving a legitimate legislative purpose. It's difficult to stand here and say that seniors, you know, in our state shouldn't be allowed additional protections in terms of being allowed to stay in their homes as long as they can, secure of the claims of their creditors. But having gone through this with an elderly parent, even if you have a home that's debt-free, you reach a certain age where the shoveling, the mowing, the general maintenance in the home provide more of a burden than a benefit. And again, the focus of my argument isn't the fact that the legislature can't, to some extent, discriminate, but it's more in the nature of the fact that it shouldn't be allowed to set up one class of individuals who can, on this issue, exempt a totally unlimited value.
So you'd be okay with a $100,000 limit for the seniors, but not unlimited. Does that fall within your argument? What if let's say they said $100,000?
If the legislature set $100,000 for seniors as opposed to 30 for the rest of us,
right,
it'd be much more difficult to come here and make that argument, because presumably then, you know, number one, they've addressed the value limitation, but secondly, they've set up two classes that at least you could analyze on the, you know, on the two-pronged test in testing the statute under that article of the Constitution.
However, if you do that, if you put a limit on the homestead, aren't you in effect then really divesting them of their home? Because if they have excess equity or excess above the limitation, wouldn't the bankruptcy procedures and the foreclosure procedures permit a forced sale to obtain that excess amount?
The execution procedures would, if you didn't reach some other agreement, allow for a divestiture of the property. But I guess this case is a good example. You've got to look at it in the context that this particular debtor is asking the court, forgive me of my $46,000 worth of debt. I don't want to provide any payment for provision for those creditors. At the same time, she's living in a house that's worth, according to her, at least $95,000. There are a lot of homes available in the city of South Dakota in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $60,000. This particular debtor had no dependents. She's a widow. And I guess the issue is, where you're not going to pay your creditors, how much is too much? You know, should you be allowed to live in a $200,000 home? She could have downsized and paid her creditors and still been secure in her home in this particular case. Not just, you know, not the home she was living in, but she certainly had the means available to be safe and secure in a home.
But yet again, a dollar limit will allow creditors.
The dollar limit.
To divest people.
Yes, it would.
Isn't, even though, you know, in value, the homestead is not limited, isn't an unlimited homestead that is limited by acreage within or without the city? Aren't there other limits put on it, some of which you've kind of referred to before, if an elderly person owns his homestead in Sioux Falls and the thing is a mansion and the taxes are $20,000 to $30,000 a year? Isn't that a limit? Isn't that a limit on an unlimited asset? Isn't the fact that he's either got to hire the snow removal or the lawn mowing or the landscaping and whatever and the maintenance on the house, aren't those actually limits that can be taken into consideration?
I see my time just ran out. Do you want me to answer this in rebuttal or?
You can go ahead. You can go ahead and answer anyway.
I'm not trying to duck the question.
Nice out, though.
What I would like to do, I'd like to address the question, but it's going to take me a little time to do it, and if you don't mind, I'd like to defer that question to when I come back on rebuttal.
That's okay. Your opponent might get a shot
at it. What I want to get into, and this is going to take some time, and when we analyze these bankruptcies, we're given schedules I and J, which are income and expense, and there are, well, I'm going to need about 5 minutes or so to address the question, and I think it's fair if I come back.
Let me ask you one other question, and this is on our time, if that's okay with you, Chief. Isn't this, as opposed to a constitutional problem, isn't this a problem of the federal laws? I mean, they could change their bankruptcy statutes, couldn't they, so that they could take care of this problem?
Are we going to start talking about the bankruptcy reform? I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think state statutes. With our system right now, the abusive cases are dealt with on an income and expense analysis, and that's what I would like to come back and talk about. But the general proposition is if you file for bankruptcy, and especially with regard to an exemption such as the homestead, which isn't income producing, you know, homestead produces expenses, it doesn't produce income, that if you're within your exemption limits, There's no way to address that problem.
Okay, we'll defer the rest till later.
All right. We'll see you again. Thank you, Mr. Lovell. Mr. Craig, you have 15 minutes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm James Craig, and I represent Dorothy Davis. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I think this is a great case, and I appreciate the fact that Judges Hoyt and Pearsall certified the question to you because it involves a very significant policy concern for our state. We get to talk about, and you get to decide, how we're going to treat the aging in our state. Last month, will we hand them a check for $30,000 and basically turn them out into the cold? That's what this case is about.
Well, really, though, isn't it telling the legislature that they may have to cap the senior level?
That is a potential outcome of this case, yes.
Mr. Lovell kind of gulped when I suggested the figure of $100,000. I think he thinks that's a little on the high side, but clearly the legislature could do that, couldn't they?
I think it can. Before addressing John's arguments, I'd like us to step back here a little bit and think about this entire process. The debtor creation, the debtor-creditor relationship is bound, and there are reasons for that. I recall as a young lawyer going into the clerk's office, bankruptcy clerk's office, and Judge Ecker had posted a sign up there to the effect that woe to you who extend credit. You know, if you extend credit, you do so at your own risk. What we're seeing here is the end of the debtor-creditor relationship. And it's important, I think, that we appreciate and understand that there are all kinds of checks and balances in the relationship up until the very end. But the very end is, at the end of the day, after the discharge is granted, what is this debtor going to be able to hang on to? And the reason that that question is so important is because we then move outside of the debtor-creditor relationship. And now we're talking about society as a whole having to address the needs of that debtor who may not have enough property left and may thus, as a result, become a burden upon society. That's why it's so critical for us to remember that there's an entire process that starts from the date the debtor-creditor relationship is created to the first default and what happens upon it, what the creditors do upon that default, and then finally, when we get into bankruptcy, what is going to happen at that point. Part of the reason that I raise this, Justice Gilbertson, is you asked, are there any other checks or balances in the system? And in fact, there are. John just mentioned the Schedules I and J. This is a relatively recent development in bankruptcy law. It resulted from creditors lobbying Congress to make it more difficult for someone to obtain a Chapter 7 discharge and forcing them into Chapter 13, where they have to pay back debt over a three-year term. This is just one of the checks on the process. Another check is the fact that a bankruptcy case can be dismissed for what's called bad faith. Here, even though we have a material cited from the state of Minnesota dealing with their unlimited homestead exemption, there is case law, I believe, and I did not throw this into brief and apologize for that, to the effect that if you're a hog, you're going to get slaughtered. A very wealthy surgeon over there was claiming homestead $750,000. And notwithstanding the unlimited homestead in Minnesota, that case was dismissed for bad faith.
I've got a question, and maybe you can't answer it, but is it valid for a creditor? Say you've got Mrs. Davis sitting in front of you, and you say, well, Mrs. Davis, ordinarily you look like you've got enough collateral here, but it's all you've got. But under the bankruptcy law, we can't foreclose on it if you file bankruptcy. Therefore, we're not going to lend you the money, where if you were 65, we would. Is that allowed?
Whoops, I'm missing you here.
I'm looking towards the front end of the transaction you've been talking about, lending people money.
Sure.
All right. Is it valid for a lender to refuse to lend Mrs. Davis money on the grounds that the collateral can't be foreclosed on because she's always over 70?
Sure. Absolutely, it's valid, and that is part of the risk analysis that should be done by creditors before they advance funds, and isn't. By and large, what we have created in this country, especially over the past few years, is a system whereby the extension of credit is based upon your credit report. Have you been diligent in making your payments? Have you fallen down? And the ramifications and the decision is more often than not based upon that. At the other end of that, when you ask, is she a good credit risk and should I be advancing her funds, I think that one of the things that the creditor looks at is, How much time does she have to repay? What is her her income and her ability, in addition to what's her track record? And in this case, the elderly are handicapped. There's no question about it.
There's a federal law that protects the elderly. There is a federal law that prohibits discrimination based on age, and so lenders can't just use age as a factor in denying credit. That's a federal law that prohibits that.
Well, I may agree with that, but there are other criteria involved. Here you have a gal who's 75 years of age. How is she going to amortize the payment of a loan with her current income? It isn't going to happen. More than that, most banks now, if they're in the mortgage business, are looking for the secondary market. We want to sell it to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or FMHA. Those underwriting guidelines for those institutions prohibit accepting that mortgage. In my brief, I said it was 2 years, but I was corrected recently. That's been extended to 4 years for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and 3 years for FMHA. So we have a situation where Mrs. Davis, were she desirous of refinancing the home and paying off the trustee, probably isn't going to get that loan because, one, she's at bad credit risk. She's been in a bankruptcy. Two, the bank isn't going to extend the debt because they've got no one to sell the paper to. Three, the cost, you've got to amortize this thing over her life, and it's got to be reasonable.
Can't she get a reverse mortgage or an equity loan against the equity in the home?
I think that she probably could, and that's one of the points made by Amicus, ARP, that many of the elderly today are relying upon those reverse mortgages, but my understanding of how they work is that it's only good for the equity, and you know, you want to be able to use that for your really pressing needs. And this is where I have trouble with the trustee's argument. Creditors...
Well, they could take a mortgage. They can take a mortgage and they're ahead, and it still would... The creditors wouldn't be able to move in there or come between her and her mortgage, you know.
True.
It would be a first mortgage, assuming there's no other mortgage. It would be a first mortgage on the property, and the bank would gain her equity in terms of advances made.
Sure. The question is, what's going to happen to the proceeds? And what trustees are arguing is, you got to pay your dividend to the existing creditors.
I'm saying she gets enough. She gets enough to live off of each year till her expected end of her life. I've got one other question kind of asked Mr. Govold about, and maybe he deferred part of it, but isn't this the bankruptcy code's problem? Couldn't the bankruptcy code be altered to provide either a provisional judgment to these creditors that would last for 20 years, and in the event the homestead ceased to be a homestead, these creditors would then be provided with an opportunity to be recouped? Or in another way, couldn't the discharge in bankruptcy be altered so that it would be a discharge as to everybody except these creditors who have a right to come in against the equity of the homestead in the event the homestead ceased to be a homestead?
I believe that would be within the federal legislature's power. You know, they look to state law for a determination of what constitutes property or a property right or a privilege such as an exemption. But they do have the ability to override that when it comes to the Federal Bankruptcy Act, and I do believe that they have that ability.
They have the ability to adjust the type of discharge they permit. Under
sure.
Bankruptcy code.
Absolutely.
And it could be a conditional discharge. It could be, you know.
Absolutely correct. And of course, if we slip outside of bankruptcy, there are still normal debtors who are restricted to their remedies under state law, and obviously you have to take that into account as well.
Honing in on the statute itself and the Constitution, because time's getting short, what kind and value has been fixed by the legislature in the statute? Why is this not unlimited and therefore unconstitutional?
I think it is limited because of the fact that the definition itself requires four elements, which are set out in 4331, 1, 2, 3, and 4. You've got to be a resident in the state. The house has to embrace the home. The homestead must embrace the house used as a home by the owner thereof. Okay, you've got a criteria right there. The homestead may contain one or more lots or tracts with buildings, but must in no case embrace different lots that, unless they're contiguous. And if it's within a town plat, it can't exceed an acre, and if it's outside, it can't exceed 160 acres. And those limitations have fluctuated over the years. When we started out, there was no acreage limitation.
But when our constitutional drafters in 1889, they were kind of plain spoken people, as far as I could ascertain, and they used the word value. You've given me four very rational criteria, but how do any of those equal value?
Well, I think I'd hearken back to the broader definition of value, and that would be this. What is the utility of the object that you're permitting them to keep? And that utility is shelter. And if you take the broader context of value, you are saying to a person, we're not going to throw you out of your house. You're going to have a property. Now, if the value is of the property is greater, the chances are that the creditors are going to, you've got a high roller. And John has been a trustee for 20 years. I was a trustee for 10 years and had over a couple thousand cases after this law was adopted in 1980. At the same time, the state opted out of the federal scheme. This came in that very same legislative session. In my years, I don't see the high rollers in bankruptcy. They're few and far between. The people you see in bankruptcy are the people in my clients' category, the low income, the middle income, and those folks have their house. It's all they've got. The amicus brief tells us what happens to seniors when they lose their home. They deteriorate rather quickly. There are ample public policy considerations for upholding what the legislature has done with this in this regard. There are limits on the area. Skinner, of course, talks about the insurance policies, and I don't quarrel with that one bit, and neither did the court in Minnesota, the Howe v. Howe decision. Look, if you've got liquid assets, that's one thing, but when it comes to a homestead, we don't necessarily need a value because we do have it limited to the area of the physical home. And for that reason, the Supreme Court in Minnesota said, that's enough. We'll stand by the area limits. We do not need a dollar limit to comply with our Constitution. And I submit to you that that should be your decision as well. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Craig. Mr. Wiest, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, David Wiest from the Attorney General's Office. I'm here today to defend the constitutionality of the statute in issue. Under Article 21, Section 4, we have language that indicates that the homestead exemption is the value of which shall be limited and defined by law. And of course, the section of the code that we're talking about here today has a homestead exemption that is commensurate with the value of the property if you are over the age of 70. Now, there's been quite a bit of talk about whether the Skinner versus Holt case controls, and I submit it does not for two reasons. First off, that case discussed personal property. And secondarily, if you look closely at Article 21, Section 4, you will find that the personal property provisions in that constitutional provision are different than the real property provisions. The real property provisions talk about value limited and defined by law, whereas the personal property definitions talk about reasonable amount and also talk about kind and value to be fixed. In my view, my argument is that when you talk about kind and value to be fixed, you are mandating a dollar certain, whereas when you drop back and talk about the first part that discusses real property, you have a value which shall be limited and defined by law. The limited part is 1 acre in town, 160 acres in the country, 43-31-4, and if it's a homestead or a mining claim, there's a different acre provision as well. That's the limitation
part. But Mr. Weist, you could put an unlimited size or value home on that property, and it would qualify.
That's correct.
Whether it's Michael Gates's mansion or it's Ms. Davis's home, it isn't going to make a difference. There's no limit on the value of the home that can be put here.
That's correct. You could build a $30,000 home on a quarter of land or a multi-million dollar home on a quarter of land. The point is the Constitution says value which shall be limited and defined by law. We have the limitation, and my argument is that the defining portion is this. When you are under the age of 70, the defining statute says that you have a homestead exemption of $30,000. If you are over the age of 70, your homestead exemption is commensurate with the value of the property. Now, this is a policy consideration that the legislature made, and whenever we make policy considerations, we must remember when we ride into that valley, we may not come out the other side. Making legislation is like making sausage. You don't necessarily want to watch it. My point is that there are stricter rules concerning the personal property exemption in the Constitution than there are regarding the real property provision of Article 21, Section 4. And of course, this court has jealously guarded homestead exemptions in the past. And we also approach this case with the thought that the statute is presumed constitutional unless proven otherwise. Now, turning to Article 6, Section 18, the test in this case is accounts management versus Williams. And first we have the criteria regarding an arbitrary classification. And the question is whether this classification was arbitrary. Well, here, everyone over the age of 70 has a homestead commensurate with the value of their property. An arbitrary classification would be that everyone who is born on Tuesday would have an unlimited homestead exemption, but everybody else would have $30,000. We don't have an arbitrary classification. We have a reasoned one made by the legislature. Secondarily, the second part of the accounts management test talks about a rational relationship between the classification and some legitimate legislative purpose. Well, obviously here, in 1980, when the South Dakota legislature in Chapter 296 enacted this law, they were looking at a problem, I think, of seniors being kicked out of their homes and what happens to them. We go to nursing homes, then we hit Title 19, and money soon runs out, and then the great state of South Dakota has to pick up the tab. So it's a weighing process that the legislature made at that time, and they decided from a policy perspective that that particular classification was certainly reasonable.
If we open the door, if we say now that if we accept your definition of the limited value, once we open that door, what's to stop the legislature then from saying, now that we've got 70-year-old people included, why not include disabled veterans? Why not include widows and widowers? Why not include farmers and ranchers? Because all those people have compelling interests as well. And then what happens to the Constitution where it talks about value limited? It seems like once we accept your definition, we open the door and pretty soon it's meaningless.
Well, the door is open insofar as the classification is constitutional under the equal protection provision of the code. And what I'm saying is that we have a rational basis in this particular set of facts. We may very well get into an instance, Justice Konenkamp, where we do not have a rational division of why one person gets an exemption and why another one does not. My example of someone born on Tuesday getting an unlimited exemption, I think, is one. There's a continuum. When we cross the line, I don't know where to tell you where it is. It's a case-by-case basis matter. I see my time is up. I would submit to the court that the question should be answered in the negative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Lovell, you have 10 minutes, sir, although I think the first 5 minutes are promised to Justice Sabres on an explanation.
If I can recall the question that I didn't answer at the end, the issue was, do the expenses of owning a very expensive home put any practical limitation on what a person might do? And I guess I'd have to agree with you that there's probably some hypothetical value that a home would have where the taxes, the maintenance, the upkeep on that home would present expenses that would be substantially higher than a, you know, than a person could afford to deal with. The problem is, again, when we are analyzing these bankruptcies, we have to take a look at the exemptions that are being claimed as of date of filing. And according to the Eighth Circuit analysis, that's all we can do. Either they fit or they don't fit. But I'd have to agree with you that in terms of a person owning a $1 million home, the expenses of owning that home would simply not be commensurate with the circumstances of somebody that is probably attempting to file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, unless you know, we're looking at one of the WorldCom executives, Enron executives, etc., you know, and most of those people either live in Texas or Florida where they, you know, they do have the unlimited exemption rights. There was also a question, are there protections built into the bankruptcy code that would prevent persons from availing themselves of large values on the homestead? And I think in one instance I can answer your question that there might be. If a person had otherwise non-exempt assets, such as liquid common stock or non-homestead real estate, and owed a lot of money to their creditors, and if on the eve of bankruptcy they transferred those assets and invested in a $500,000 home, the existing bankruptcy law might provide some protection. Mr. Craig was referring to the pigs and hogs language of the Eighth Circuit, and I think the phrase is that pigs are fed, hogs get slaughtered. But the issue is, what can you do by way of pre-planning before you file a bankruptcy? And the law has drawn a rather undefined law to the effect that you can do some pre-planning. The courts are going to allow you to build your exemptions. But if you cross an imprecise line, then you get into 547, 548, and 549 issues under 11 U.S.C., which are the transfers and fraud of creditors. As a trustee, I am allowed to make the argument to the court, if I find somebody that has done too much, quote-unquote, pre-planning exemption building, I have the ability to file a complaint with the bankruptcy court seeking to set those transfers aside. But generally, they would have had to have occurred within a year of filing. And getting back to the homestead claim, if the person had been in that home for any period over a year, I don't think there are any circumstances where the existing bankruptcy code would address the situation.
Now, we're here today because the legislature opted out of the federal standards for exemptions, is my understanding, and inserted its own.
Correct.
Under the federal system, if they had not opted out, does the federal system recognize a two-tiered system like this, where you've got a cap dollar-wise on younger folks and seniors get a little break?
I don't believe so, but I didn't adequately prepare myself before I came up here to really address the question and feel good about giving you an answer on that.
Fair enough.
How did, now, Mr. Craig mentioned the Minnesota cases. How do you distinguish those cases?
I guess the best way to distinguish them is that the language under the Minnesota Constitution is not the same language as contained in Article 21, Section 4 of our Constitution. I think the Minnesota constitutional language refers to a quote-unquote reasonable amount, but there are distinct differences in the language, and my answer to that contention is we have to interpret our own constitution, and the Minnesota case is speaking about a different and distinct document really don't have any bearing on the issue that's been raised.
What about the difference in the language of our constitution between personal property and the homestead?
Yeah, Justice, I've looked at that, and I really have trouble reading that language to give the legislature any more authority to walk away from a value limitation on a homestead right as opposed to a personal property right.
They had to have meant something different, or they would have used the same words.
The words are about as close as they possibly could be. I can read the language as suggesting that the legislature needs to be tougher on homestead values than personal property values. The language is somewhat different, but I can't find any major distinctions. One other question that was asked, and I guess I'd like to go back to it. The question is, you know, can Congress provide any protections? And I think out of fairness, I can think of something that's come up under the bankruptcy reform legislation that's been stalled in Congress now for the last 4 or 5 years. We do have the opt-out, and I think even after any type of bankruptcy reform, we're still going to have the opt-out where the state of South Dakota can choose to follow its own exemption laws. But there has been an uproar in Congress over the fact that Texas and Florida primarily, especially after all these corporate scandals of a few years ago, afford residents of those states unlimited homesteads. In fact, it's sort of become a joke. But at various times, I think there have been proposals suggested to go into the reform legislation where even though a state can opt out, Congress could speak to the fact that under no circumstances are we going to allow a person going through bankruptcy to claim a homestead of more than X number of dollars. I think there may have even been some of those suggestions made in the last few years, but to my knowledge, the Texas and Florida lobbying interests in Congress are such where right now I don't think the reform legislation includes any caps. But Congress theoretically could probably tinker with the system and put in caps. But I,
to the best of your recollection, what was the X that you referred to? Was it a couple hundred thousand dollars or higher?
I don't recall for certain, but it seems like it was in the neighborhood of a couple of hundred thousand.
Okay. It's far beyond what we're dealing with here in this.
Probably far
the
beyond
state
what we got. That's correct. All right. That's correct. But I guess the bottom line, and I'll end with this, is that particularly with Article 21, Section 4, the Constitution does mandate that value be limited, and it's my contention that the statute is deficient to that respect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lovell. Hold it. You're not quite done.
So, if you're successful in your argument, then this provision would be held unconstitutional, and would just go back to the bankruptcy court, and she'd have no exemption other than the $30,000?
She'd have a $30,000 exemption.
Just because she's a person and...
She's just like any other citizen. The balance of the statute, I assume, would survive. She'd claim her $30,000 right, and at that point, I think she'd have several options. Number one, she could negotiate a settlement within the context of her Chapter 7. Secondly, she could elect to convert to a Chapter 13. We haven't discussed this in the argument before, but when she filed her bankruptcy, she had the option of electing to proceed under Chapter 13, which is a form of bankruptcy which does allow the debtor to keep all property, but secondly, she's allowed to basically, within the context of the 13 bankruptcy, finance her value issues on the homestead value over a 3 to a 5 year period.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lovell. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.